tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. A lot of our practice is putting attention onto the different factors that help to fulfill the path, bringing together almost like a critical mass of wholesome and skillful qualities that allow the mind to become settled, to become still, to become clear. And sometimes we wonder why it doesn't. You know, we do the technique or we do the method, and the mind isn't as clear as we would like, or as steady as we would like. But the important focus is not sort of worrying so much about that result, but putting in the causes. Putting in the causes for these, this kind of critical mass of wholesome dhammas. And, you know, on a certain level we get it. In that, say, if we're, you know, we go to lunch and you take a bite or two of your lunch, and you don't start wondering, gee, I'm not full yet. What's wrong? This is food, and I'm still hungry. And, you know, and so you just keep eating until you're full. And the time is a bit different in the sense of. And it's something that we recognize. Yeah, you just have to keep eating until you're full. Say the image that Ajahn Chah uses is the image of the gardener. What the gardener does is when they're planting a tree, and the duty of the gardener is to dig the hole, prepare the soil, fertilize it, water it, keep the bugs away, and then the tree will grow according to its own nature. You know, whether it's a peas or beans or whether it's an apple tree, they're going to grow in different ways. They're going to give fruit in a different timeline. And in a different way. When it comes to our own spiritual practice, it's very similar. Be ready to put in the appropriate causes, and to be patient with how the fruits of the practice manifest. And I think certainly for most of us, it isn't a matter of, you know, practicing for one retreat or 1 year or a few years. It really has to unfold over time. Because that, and even though one some sort of spiritual transformation to take place overnight, it really relies on this cumulative momentum of an array of wholesome qualities. So to be attentive to the cultivation of these qualities, and that's something we can do. We can't push the mind or coerce the heart into some spiritual liberation, but we can lay the causes in a circumspect and thorough way. There's a discourse where a monk is living with the Buddha, and he's his attendant at that time, and they're living out in the countryside someplace in solitude, and the attendant monk goes on alms around, and he sees this really nice area where there's a river right nearby, there's a mango grove, and it just seems so idyllic and perfect for practice. So he conceives in his mind, this is really what I'd like to do, is come here and live in solitude and practice. So he goes back to the Buddha, and he informs the Buddha of his intention and this inspiration to have that period of time in solitude to really practice. And the Buddha makes a simple request and said, just right now, I'm on my own. Wait until another monk comes, and then the monk is fired up with inspiration and is impatient to get on with his practice, and so he makes a request again, explaining what he'd like to do, and saying, the Blessed One has done what needs to be done. There's nothing further to add to what the Blessed One has done. But for me, I'm still struggling. I still have work to do. Please let me go and practice. So then the Buddha replies in the same way. Just be patient and wait for another monk to come. I'm on my own now. Of course, as these things happen in the scriptures, it's a third time, and then the Buddha says, acquiesces and says, "Since you speak of striving in your practice, then go ahead." So the monk goes off and finds his idyllic mango grove by the river, and sits down in perfect conditions as he conceived it for his development of practice and trying to bring about a fruition of his training. And said, and as he's meditating, his mind is overwhelmed by thoughts of sensuality, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming. So that's the kind of the phrase, and so that he spends his time on retreat struggling with a completely unruly mind, and after some time out of frustration and feeling abashed, he heads back to the Buddha and explains what's happened, and then the Buddha said, "Well, for one whose release of mind is still immature, there are these five qualities that need to be cultivated, the first one is the association with having admirable friendship, or having good spiritual friendship, So that having that companionship in one's practice, that is where one has good examples and good mentors. So that being the first the first sort of condition, and then the Buddha says the second condition is that one is virtuous, and one's training in the precepts, training in the rules of discipline, that one is consummate in one's conduct and as the idiom that's used, seeing danger in the slightest faults, in that sense of having a a real kind of a assiduous application toward that sense of virtue and wholesomeness, skillfulness in conduct and speech as a supportive condition. Then the third supportive condition that the Buddha points to is that one is able to hear the teachings, hear, have a conversation on topics that are and said easily and at will, that are conducive to one's spiritual development, that one can hear the Dhamma that is concerning the aspects of modesty, of contentment, of living in seclusion, being diligent, being having virtue, having the concentration, wisdom, discernment, release, and knowledge and vision of release. So these are the aspects of conversations and discussion that one can be a part of. And then the fourth quality being that one is living with one's persistence or effort aroused, that one is directing one's effort and energy towards the relinquishing of unwholesome dhammas, unwholesome qualities, and towards the arousal and maintaining of the of wholesome dhammas, wholesome qualities, that one is not. That one is diligent in one's efforts towards putting forth effort. And then the last quality that the Buddha points to as a supportive condition is the attentiveness to arising and ceasing, the impermanence, inconstancy, change, uncertainty, that one is attentive to that arising, coming into being and passing away, whether it's of mental phenomena or material phenomena around one, one's paying attention to that, which forms the basis of insight and penetration and relinquishment, so that these five qualities the Buddha uses as a framework for supportive conditions for one who's release of mind is still immature. And then the Buddha goes on to say that for one who is who draws close to admirable friends, who keeps good spiritual friendships, then it's natural or ordinary, or it's to be expected that that person would be one who is virtuous. It's quite natural, quite ordinary, and also that when one has good spiritual friendship, it's to be expected that one would hear the Dhamma, have conversations on matters that support the spiritual path. When one has admirable friendship, it's to be expected that one would be one who lives with one's effort and persistence aroused. And similarly, when one has good spiritual friends, that one would dwell contemplating arising and ceasing, coming into being and falling away, that this is an aspect of phenomena and experience that one would start tuning into. So that the Buddha predicates the growth in Dhamma on our associations, and that this is laying the foundations for our cultivation of other wholesome and supportive spiritual qualities, so that the this aspect of spiritual friendship is a very important quality. In fact, there's another a very famous and well-known sutta that most people probably know, but it's worth repeating, where Ananda has the insight that half of the holy life is having good spiritual friends, and he goes to the Buddha and recounts his insight, and then the Buddha sort of saying, well, it's not just half the holy life, it's actually all of the holy life. This cultivation of admirable friendship, having good spiritual friends, is really the whole of the holy life. But it's also interesting to how in that same discourse where the Buddha goes on to say, and how does one who has good spiritual friendship practice the path? And so then it goes on to say that one that has good kalyanamitta, good spiritual friendship, practices the Eightfold Path with each factor of the path supported by certain qualities of seclusion, dispassion, cessation, relinquishment. So that cultivating right view with those qualities, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, through to right concentration. Each factor of the path is supported by those qualities of seclusion, dispassion, cessation, relinquishment. So that's that kind of fills out both the picture of spiritual friendship and the desired result, in that It's not, say, it's like in the Hindu tradition, there's that sense of darshan. One goes into the midst of a good spiritual teacher, and one immediately sort of gets the benefits. And the Buddha is a bit more prosaic in his approach, and saying, "No, yeah, you go seek out good spiritual friendship, and then you do the work." To me, it always made much more sense that way. After the Buddha had explained these supportive conditions to the monk, and I think it is really important to recognize how critical it is to direct our attention to supportive conditions, because sometimes we want to, when we're meditating or when we're practicing, and we easily look at the results we're expecting, wondering when they're going to come, how to get them, and the attention to coming back another step or two, and laying the foundations for these wholesome qualities to gain momentum within the heart, and as they gain momentum, as they start to, it's almost like knitting together the fabric of our spiritual well-being. That's where the results of calm, of clarity, of discernment, that's where it comes from. After the Buddha spoke of those, and he said, once one has these these five conditions, then one should attend to four further factors, and then the Buddha goes into actual technique, and he just actually goes through it quite. It's almost sort of point by point. He says, to cultivate the perception of the unattractive, to counter sensual desire, to cultivate the loving kindness as a means of overcoming ill will, cultivating mindfulness of breathing to overcome restlessness, cultivating developing the reflections on impermanence and inconstancy, in order to undermine the assumption of I am. And then the Buddha goes on, and when one, as one undermines that assumption of I am, one perceives not self. When one perceives not self, that in itself is nibbana in the present moment. So that the experience of being able to drop the obsession with I am, the in Pali with asamimana, that assumption, the belief, the deep-rooted feeling of I-ness. So these are the practices that we start to pay attention to as we're developing our meditation, and these are for balance, so that when the mind goes toward sensual desire, getting the infatuations with gratification, seeking pleasure and comfort, security, these are to be able to counter that with the perceptions of the unattractive, and presenting another picture, because the way desire works is that it paints a believable picture of the pleasure and gratification that one is going to receive. If you remember, I was teaching somewhere, and then stayed at the house of a layperson, and they stayed that night. In the morning, had breakfast there, and they had a special breakfast. There's two young kids in the family, and so they had I wanted to do a special breakfast for us, which was also what the kids wanted, and so was pancakes. So then the little boy was, because the monks were there, then he got to slather the pancakes with as much butter and as much maple syrup as he could get away with, and then he was, and it was really great the way the mom. Because didn't sort of say, don't do this. Now, pay attention to what's happening. Do you really need that much? There was the second one, the third one, and it was getting on to the fourth one, and mom was really good, and he said, okay, pay attention. How are you feeling? I feel sick. Well, that was that's what desire does. It paints the picture of I really need this. This is just going to be so good. And then I feel sick. So bringing to mind the unattractive nature of things, because there's always the two sides. And in particular, the classic meditation is the unattractive nature of the body. And the main reason, of course, is usually the body is the vehicle for our gratification in whatever way, shape or form it takes. So then and of course we've got our body with us and we can contemplate it. And paying attention to the different body parts, as the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, which is on the surface, then going internally, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, internal organs, different body fluids. And just going over that, going contemplating that. And it has a real soothing quality to it, in the sense of really helping to bring to mind that sense of dispassion, cooling, a cooling of the passions. So that it's a very useful tool, and it can be, one can take that unattractive nature of any, the mind goes out to painting the picture of what this is going to be so good, or that's going to be so so exciting, or this is going to be so wonderful, and to just walk through it. Is that what's the other side of the picture? What's the other side of the coin? And and it's not to just go around as a kind of kind of a miserable party pooper, but it's for one's own cooling and soothing of that which tends to excite and place us into a situation where we overstep the bounds of wisdom, and we end up suffering again. We end up dissatisfied, discontent. So that being able to look at things in a broader picture and recognizing, okay, there's something else there. And then using that theme of the unattractive in order to allay that the habit of passion and infatuation. Cultivation of, and say that's a balance. And the same with the balance of loving kindness to counter the tendency to ill will, to aversion, to negativity. When the mind dwells too much on the side of the critical, negative, the mind becomes I'm thinking what comes to mind is a word in Thai, which means like it's like shriveled and shrunken. So it's like shrunken and shriveled. And that's what happens when the excessive negativity and aversion, that aversive mind doesn't lead to a sense of expansiveness and brightness. It shrinks in on itself. So that to be able to counter that, to balance it, and that's where the conscious cultivation of loving kindness is, that well wishing, so that bringing to mind that wish towards ourselves first and then to others, may I abide in well being, may I be happy, may I be. May I be secure, may I be at ease, and just whatever phrases are resonate for one, and then to drop that into consciousness and allow that to ripple out to settle it, and so that that perception of goodwill of caring for oneself and for others starts to ripple out. And that leads to a real a brightness and a expansive, wholesome mental states. So to be able to consciously cultivate that. These are ways of balancing the mind, and really the, you know, in terms of say the duty or skill of a practitioner, is not just getting some kind of a technique, some kind of method, some meditation method, and then to be able to perfect, that method of being, you know, becoming a good breather, but to be attentive to what is the mind actually need? What is the experience right now? What does it need to be balanced? And then applying that balance, the balancing factors or the supportive factors that allow the mind to become and the heart to become steady and clear. As the Buddha recommending mindfulness of breathing to help to counter restlessness, discursive thought, that mind that's thinking, projecting, planning, speculating, so to take that energy and apply it to the rhythm of the breath, something that is neutral and soothing and settling. I mean, it's like breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. I mean, sort of like when one sort of a baby is kind of cranky and not very happy, and you're rocking it in a cradle, and it just rocking back and forth, and it settles. Now the mind is similar. This discursive thoughts spinning out in proliferation, is coming back to that simple rhythm of the breath, allowing the mind to absorb into the rhythm of the breath, allowing the physical rhythm of the in breath and out breath to soothe that restless mind, and to attending to that. The reflections and investigations around impermanence, around inconstancy, around change, and that seeing that whether it's a mental phenomena, a mood, a thought, whether it's a sensation in the body, whether it's the body itself, whether it's the kind of the world around us, paying attention to the impermanent nature, but in particular to our own experience, because that's where we undermine the assumptions of I am-ness, the assumptions of this is who I am, this is me, I am this, so that. Because if we follow it rationally, whatever we think we are in terms of a mood, a feeling, an impression, what are we when it changes? When it's not there, when it's gone, so that there's and of course, what happens is the mind just keeps following its habit of association, and it just changes the focus. But that's where that paying attention to that rise and fall, coming into being and cessation, and then because it's at that point of when we're making that very conscious, that we can allow it to cease without the mind impulsively or compulsively making those associations of beingness, of becoming, with the next thought, the next feeling. Be willing to stay with as the sensation of the breath comes to an end, as a particular thought ends, paying attention to that so that the mind isn't just moving forward. And you'll find that there's all of a sudden there can be a tension there because the compulsion is so ingrained. And to be able to recognize that, that is this asamimana, this I am, and that's what's driving, it's kind of the driving engine behind how there's sort of defilements and attachments manifest in greed, hatred, and delusion. But it's that underlying. Yeah, that I am-ness. So to attend to that, and when we're able to recognize that, can be a real relinquishment and setting down, a clarity that comes from that. That being able to see through that I am, and it's just through something incredibly ordinary. Impermanence of phenomena, impermanence, change, the rising and falling. This is when the other day, yesterday morning, when we recited the Dhammacakka Sutta and the when Kundanya understood, and what Kundanya understood, what was the basis for his entering the stream of Dhamma, whatever has the nature to arise, that has the nature to cease. And this is an idiom that comes up all through the suttas, expressing that shift from the your ordinary unawakened being to somebody who has realized Dhamma, and it said that in Pali the yam kinchi samudaya dhammang sabandhang nirodha dhammang. So whatever has the nature to arise, whatever is arising, all that ceases. And so that to consciously reflect on that, or consciously investigate that, and because on a certain level it's just really ordinary, you think, and the implications aren't clear to one until one starts to bring it into the heart and realize how pervasive that is, and how it's key. It's a key factor for being able to set aside, put down, relinquish our attachments and assumptions. I can remember when I was a fairly young monk, and my brother came to visit me in Thailand, and he asked me what it was that why am I living as a monk, and why not so much why am I living as a monk, but what is it that is useful or beneficial or special that has made me be willing to stay as a monk. And then I naively said, wow, it's just really seeing how everything is impermanent and changing. I was really being struck by that at the time. And how change is so pervasive. And my brother looked at me as if I was nuts. And he said, like everybody knows that. You know, like what's wrong with you? He's got this brother who's really lost it. But it's everybody does know it, but not many people really draw it into the heart and allow it to change them. Allow that in, and see the implications and how we predicate all of our assumptions of the world outside and the world inside from that assumption of that it's not going to change, it's going to be the way I like it, it's going to be the way I want it, it should be this way, it should be that way. But when we really allow that, ordinary truth of arising and ceasing, radically transform ourselves. So these are sort of part of the Buddha's toolkit for balancing, for developing a stability and strength in our practice. So that these different factors, and I think that's one of the characteristics of the Buddha's teachings, is that he is always pointing to causes and conditions, and it's through these causes and conditions that this comes into being. It's through these, the absence of these causes and conditions, that things cease. So that for our own aspiration for cultivation, then we need to be attentive and skilled at bringing into being and supporting conditions that are going to be for our welfare and our understanding. So I'll offer that for reflection as well.